You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming out. Fortunately, not as cold a day today as it was yesterday. Yesterday we had a brief phone conversation. This is the first time I've met Ben. I've known his work since Radio Congo and have enjoyed him as an author from the very first. And I begged off talking about how I wanted to approach this conversation. So now I'm going to spring the terms that I have in mind. And because it's a conversation, it's negotiable. You can say whatever you'd like and propose whatever you'd like. But I have three particular lenses in mind for coming at the book. First of all, one should begin by saying what a remarkable work of reportage this is. Getting really deeply into scene and into character and personal histories and experiences and developing a real kind of fly on the wall kind of perspective on so much of what you will read in these pages. But, you know, the book pretends or is ostensibly about a particular place, a refugee camp that is said to be the largest refugee camp in the world. It's really a permanent city, in effect. But it's really about a lot more than that. And so the three lenses that I would propose get to this notion that I have of this being about more than that. It's about entry or arrival. It's about the lived experience of this camp as a city, and it's about exit for those few who manage to move on beyond the city. And so when we get into the conversation, I'd like to sort of have you tackle each of those themes, and I'm familiar with the stories because I know the book, but many of you, I assume, will not have yet read the book, and so we can choose some of the best histories and anecdotes to kind of get at these three different, very different types of experience, if you'd like. Yeah. Before we do that, though, I'd like, excuse me, to just do clear up some kind of biographical business here. I mean, you can't read an extraordinary work of reportage like this without wondering about the person who produced it. And so I would like to begin with you telling us how you came to this topic. I know a little bit about it from the blurb, et cetera, but I think the audience would benefit from having a more extended explanation of this. You know, you spent years at this project in various capacities. What drew you there professionally, personally? What made you persist and stick around? Well, I'll just stop there. That's enough of an entry point, I think.
Okay. Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure to be here. I agreed to the three lenses. I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it. In terms of my own background, the Open Society Fellowship came at precisely the right point in my journey in Dadaab, because I first came to the place in 2010 as a researcher for Human Rights Watch in the Horn of Africa. Prior to that, I had worked as a speechwriter in politics in the UK to the Liberal Party, trying to stop Tony Blair's war in Iraq. Having failed, I felt a bit heartbroken and pretty cynical about British politics, so I went to get involved in what I thought was perhaps more pure politics in a sense of human rights advocacy for Human Rights Watch. First in Uganda and then in Kenya, the elections in Kenya in 2008, Ethiopia, Somalia, Nigeria, other countries. But the experience of working as a researcher for Human Rights Watch during that time, the most arresting experience I had was in Dadaab. And it was not only the sheer fact of this city that I had never heard about and shocked me the way that it was there and shouldn't be, really. But it was the everyday stories of how people survived and lived in this place, and actually the view of the world from this kind of planet that was apart from the world. The phrase that's often in my head is a Zen Buddhist idea of being in the world but not of the world. And it feels like very much like a sort of separate world. And I was fascinated by how those people saw the rest of the world. So quite quickly after that initial experience, I went back to Dadaab under my own steam, on holiday, if you like, from Human Rights Watch, and tried to get around and meet people and see if I could write a book about the place. But I arrived on the week that the Médecins Sans Frontières workers were kidnapped. So the whole place was on lockdown. And very quickly, it became clear that I wouldn't get permission from the UN to do the kind of project I wanted to do. It was also very clear that it was going to become too expensive because you were mandated to have, and you still are as a result of the kidnapping, security. So you have to visit foreign visitors, especially white-skinned ones like me. If you get kidnapped in the camp, all of the services are shut down. So the biggest disservice you can do to the refugees who are relying on the UN is to get kidnapped. So some kind of gung-ho journalist like me coming in there would not have been useful. So I had to rethink. And at that point, then I took stock and made the application for the OSI Fellowship, and then that enabled me to go back for pretty much 2 years on and off, interviewing people again and again and again, as is necessary for this kind of work. And that process finished only a year ago, really. I mean, the epilogue was written in the summer.
So did you arrive on vacation and then leave quickly, or did you just simply abandon the idea of this vacation?
No, I stayed for 2 weeks to do as much as I could. Mm-hmm. But it became clear after those 2 weeks that it wasn't going to work in the way that I'd imagined it. I was hoping to basically go and live there for a while in the camp with the people I'd met. So it posed all sorts of problems, because then the kind of intimate reportage that I wanted to do is best accomplished when you actually live with people. If you're trying to go there with a truck full of armed policemen and you're only able to stay for 2 hours because then the policemen are tapping their watch and saying, we got to go back to the UN bomb-proof compound, it made the whole thing a lot more complicated. So the conditions under which the research were done were very difficult.
Never mind the intimidating effect of the police presence in the first place.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. I'm a journalist, so I'm going to ask a couple of technical questions that I hope won't bore the audience here. But how does one apply to go to vacation at a place like Dadaab? I mean, you were no longer with Human Rights Watch. I mean, under what auspices does one approach the UN to ask for permission for something like that?
Well, I mean, you need a permission from the Kenyan government, the Department of Refugee Affairs, and then you need... the UN can't really... I suppose they could stop you. But generally they don't. They allow people, visitors, to come. They require that you stay in the compound so that they can keep an eye on you. But the Department of Refugee Affairs, I had got my permission before the kidnap, so they were very relaxed about it. They thought it was a big joke. Mm-hmm. You know, I introduced myself as a freelance writer. You have to have a sponsor. So I got my agent in London to write a letter saying he's a good guy and he wants to research some stories. And that was fine. They stamped the letter and they gave me permission. After that, I had to always go with a letter from OSF saying, you know, this is what he's up to and his bona fides and so on. So, there's paperwork, but it's possible.
Mm-hmm. So you go off and you get a fellowship and then you return. Can you describe a little bit your sort of entry points into this society as you returned now with an official project and the backing of an organization like this?
Well, through the initial visits with Human Rights Watch, I met translators, community leaders, people like that. And then through my own subsequent trip, I met other people, some of whom were, three of whom I then followed up with who were in the book from that first trip. So I already had those relationships. I cast the net quite widely. To begin with, I was terrified, to be honest. How do you even start a project like this? How do you choose your characters? I knew I wanted characters because I knew I wanted to upend the sort of big picture analysis and I wanted to approach it from the ground up. But how do you choose those characters? I don't know. So I started off with just casting that very widely. I interviewed about 50 or 60 people and picked the ones I thought were had interesting stories, who came from interesting places, or some who had were recent arrivals, some who were born in the camp, because the camp is 25 years old. And that first trip was about 6 weeks, and then I went back 6 weeks later for a month, and then we sort of narrowed it down. And after a year, I had about 12 characters, and then the final cut was 9 in the book.
Mm-hmm. You describe the population of the camp in terms of generations. From memory, I think you very roughly talk about two different distinct generations. Could you tell the audience what you had in mind by that?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a device in the sense that this is just a description of how the camp is. Mm-hmm. The camps were formed in 91 by 90,000 people coming from Somalia when the government collapsed and the civil war began. That core population see themselves as a kind of, if not aristocracy, then as a sort of, founding fathers, if you like, of the camp. So there's a core population in the camp, and then new waves of refugees have come. In the late 2000s, in 2011 was a very big influx from the famine in Somalia, southern Somalia, in that year. And then of every refugee has their own story, so people have come for many other reasons. But in the camp, there are these two main populations, and the older generations have, of course, much more completely lived in the camp for longer. So you have three generations now. You have people whose grandchildren were born in the camp, who are now in primary school. You have people who have no memory of Somalia, who grew up in the camp, who went to school in the camp, who speak Swahili, who speak English, who are now pursuing degrees online and so on, who very much see themselves as part of... How do they see them? They see themselves as a sort of middle class in exile, waiting to go back to Somalia to try and rebuild the country. And they have a model government. They have their own little, what they call cabinet, which meets in the White House, in the youth center in the camp. So they have a real sense of themselves as, the sort of saviors in waiting, if you like. Then the more recent arrivals, the victims of the famine, like Isha in the book, who brought her 5 children 16 days on foot from Somalia, they have a very different relationship to the camp. They don't necessarily see the camp as home. They haven't quite yet buried generations of their families in the sand there. They don't have the material attachment to the land. And that's why... So both of those different groups have very different ideas of exit. They have different... For those who've come more recently, going home is much more of an option because they still have the relationships back home. They perhaps still have access to land where they can make a living. Whereas the guys who were born and raised in the camp, there is only one exit for them, and that is another country, really.
So you anticipated what I wanted to ask you a little bit, which is about the theme of longing, which is a very sort of powerful motif that runs through much of the book. And I was going to ask you if there's some differential diagnosis about longing that separates these generations. In other words, the people who have no memory of, their generations into this experience versus the people who have relatively recently arrived. How do they process this longing differently?
Yes. Well, there's a word in Somali which is bufis, which is a kind of depression, really, which means this longing for resettlement. Because according to refugee law, there are three possible durable solutions to being displaced. One is to return to your home country. One is to be integrated into your country of asylum, in this case Kenya. The third is resettlement to a third country, so usually that means Europe or America. And that word bufis, which people use jokingly and when somebody's not doing too well, or for example, my friend Tawane in the book, when he hears that his sister has been selected for resettlement to Canada, he has a headache for a week. He's flat out. He can't cope. It's too much. Why isn't it him? You know, why not me? You know, when he's done so much and he's contributed so much to the youth club in the camp. Those who've grown up in the camp are part of that culture. This whole culture centered on leaving. So to remain in Dadaab in some ways is some kind of failure. And when the phone rings and there's somebody in Minneapolis or London or Italy, and they tell the they ask for news from home. All the guys, I was sitting with these guys, passing the phone around, very sort of tentatively talking to the friend in Italy, because they all felt ashamed that they didn't have either the audacity or the cash to make that journey themselves. So for people who've been there since the 1990s, they are also the victim of an outdated international policy. Once upon a time, the UN had a quota system, it still does, have a quota system for resettlement. So you share the burden of the refugees in the camp, and rich countries generally accepted much, much larger numbers. So when the camp started, people were leaving to North America in their thousands, to Canada, to the United States, and in lesser numbers to Europe. Now that pipeline has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, has narrowed. So at the moment, we're talking about just over 1,000 people a year who get resettled to the United States or to Europe. The UK, for example, takes around 100 a year.
Remind the audience of out of how many, what population we're talking about.
Yeah, the total population, the official refugee population is around 400,000. The unofficial size of the camp is probably closer to 600,000. The birth rate in the camp is 1,000 people a month. So there is no way that this quota system is ever going to diminish that population, let alone, you know, start dropping. So this is the global refugee crisis, and part of the symptom is the numbers of people coming into Europe illegally. But the bigger part, the hidden part that doesn't get in the news so often, is the existence of all of these cities, which are growing. Both the number of cities are growing, and each of the cities is actually growing. But to return to the culture point, if you came to the camp in the 90s, part of the reason you're not going to leave is because you're hoping that you're going to be what they call in process, that you're desperately waiting for your number to come up, and that it's going to be your turn to have resettlement to the United States.
I was quite touched by, and I don't know how this plays into the generational divide, if at all, but I was quite touched by, there's a moment in the book where he describes the arrival of Facebook via the mobile phone as being a kind of aggravator of this boofus, that instead of being a source of relief because it's connecting you with the bigger, broader community out in the world, and you can sort of keep up on the news and maintain conversations with people and whatnot, it's actually a source of despair.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, it's like sand in your face, really, because you're, as I said, the culture centered on leaving, so people are very much connected. There are, all of the camps have their own names, and all of the youth in those camps have their own Facebook groups. So, for example, the main camp that I focused on was called IFO. There's five. And there's an IFO Youth closed group, mind you, on Facebook. It took me a long time to get admitted, but it's all in Somali anyway, so I don't understand very much. But some of it's in English. But they people there are posting, and of course you have very close relationships to the people that you grew up with, you went to school with, some of whom are in, as I said, Minnesota or London, some of whom are in the camp. And the disparity is very, very difficult to take. So my friend Tawani, for example, feeling, you know, pretty much every time he logs on, feeling depressed. It's a reminder of what, you know, the bad luck that has befallen him, that he hasn't had these opportunities. So one of the curious consequences of this is that people are quite creative with Facebook. So you might see people saying that they're from a town that they're not from. So one of the characters in the book is, while he's in Dadaab, he's actually, his hometown is Accra in Ghana. And he was recently in Paris France, and there's a picture of him under the Eiffel Tower with his face photoshopped onto somebody else's face. And he's laying claim to these images that are inaccessible to him. They're accessible in that way. So he's building a sort of imaginary life for himself that he would like to lead, but which is out of reach.
So going back to the older generation, the aristocracy, as you put it, these are people who one senses very generally have no illusion that they're ever going to make it out of the camp. What, even though they have this moment of tension when the phone rings, right? What are the psychic costs of this? And beyond that, I wonder also, because our audience will not have read the book again, if you can speak to I think the audience thinking, wondering what it means to be in a refugee camp for an entire generation, or to be the second generation in a refugee camp. What does this mean? Just simply sitting around waiting for the telephone call, or is there some other kind of life in the refugee camp? Of course, there's an economy there, right?
Yes,
so what does this all mean?
Over 25 years, there has grown up a black market, a grey economy. So there are shops in the camp. There are buses, there are hotels, there are soccer leagues. There are, you know, in the market, you can buy an iPhone, you can buy a tractor, you can buy tomatoes, you can buy ammunition, you can buy everything. And it's
very... sex.
You can buy sex, too.
Alcohol.
Yes, alcohol,
right.
Yeah. Drugs, possibly, although I never tried. But you can... it's very connected to Somalia, so there's a lot of smuggled goods from Somalia. There is, of course, all of the rations, the refugee, the UN food, which is on sale. Back in the original early days, the only way to really acquire cash, unless you brought cash with you from Somalia or you sold stuff, was to hoard your rations and then sell them. So if you wanted to start a business, you had to go hungry. You saved a kilo of rice every week for a year, and then you could start a shop, for example. So there's one guy in the book whose wife did that for 2 years, started a shop, and now he's a very rich man. He can't leave; he's still in the camp, but he did actually wire his sons in California $75,000 to buy a truck to start a business because he didn't like the fact that they were cleaning toilets. So. There is money. There are some millionaires, very few, but there are some very rich people. There is this black grey economy, and although the psychological, yes, that is a world of sorts. It's a city that functions in a dysfunctional way. It is a life, and people do adapt themselves to it. Nevertheless, they are aware of this other world spinning outside, which they're not a part of. And that does create incredible stresses on people's sense of self. So the way I thought of it was as a kind of pressure cooker. It's a bit like the Truman Show, where when you gradually realize that there is this other world outside, and you feel the victim of some kind of joke. So it's like the sky is really pressing down all the time, and it makes people's sense of self quite slippery. So yes, they do understand at root that they probably will never leave, but it's very hard for people to accept that. So your daily life is this constant struggle to manufacture hope, to find something to believe in, something to latch on your ambitions to believe that, for example, Cairo is a young girl who spends her whole life working very, very hard at school, because Canada offers scholarships to the top 10 girls who graduate secondary school in the camp. There are only 2,000 places at secondary school. There's an intense competition to get a place. So when she graduated primary school, there was a big party. Her whole extended family was delighted that she might have that meant that she had a shot at getting to Canada. So all the secondary school kids dream of going to Canada. They look it up on the internet. They pick which courses they're going to do at which universities. They get very excited. But only 20 make it. 10 girls and 10 boys every year. So she unfortunately missed the cut and didn't get there. So one day she's saying, yes, I'm going to go to Canada, and it's going to be like this and that and the other. And then the next day she's saying, oh, Ben, you know, I'm never leaving here. What am I going to do? And then another day she's saying, well, you know, maybe I'll buy an illegal Kenyan ID if I get some money and I'll go to Nairobi. And so every day you're trying to think of something that gives you some sort of horizon.
One of the great triumphs of the book is the sort of depth of realization of the actual characters. And so returning to the idea of these three lenses, I wonder if we can get into some individual stories. And if you don't mind starting with the sort of ingress, the arrival into the camp. And there's a very dramatic, I don't remember the name of the character.
Guled,
right. Yes, very dramatic, story involving escape from Al-Shabaab and his arrival in the camp and sort of understanding the landscape of this place afresh, really. And then you also mentioned the mother later who arrives with five children. So I wonder if you could you sort of lay out the lineaments of those two individual stories?
Sure. Guled is a young boy who, at the time I met him, would have been about, I think, 17. He was born in 1993, around, as far as I can ascertain, he doesn't really know, but it would have been pretty close to the date when the Black Hawk Down helicopters were shot down in Mogadishu. And he was born in Wardaglade District, which is the district in which they crashed. He then spent the next 16 years growing up in the city. His parents died very early on, but his elder sister survived. He was raised by her, and she sold petrol in the ruins of Mogadishu. All of this time, he was still going to school, because although primary enrollment in Mogadishu was down to about 25%, although it's a war zone, people were still struggling. It was, for them, it was an act of resistance. It was part of, you know, trying to stay alive and have hope. So a long story short, but by 2010, he's going to primary school. And one day, he, just after break, he was sitting in class, and he sees the teacher at the front of the class, who sees the color drain from his face, and he sees him go into shock. And all the children wonder what's going on. They turn around, and they see seven Al-Shabaab guys with black scarves wrapped around their head and machine guns walking down the center of the classroom, picking out all of the tallest boys in the class, and Guled is one of them. They take the seven boys outside, put them into a pickup truck, blindfold them, and drive them to a training camp. So for the next month, Guled is a conscript for Al-Shabaab. They dispatch him as a hizbat, which is the morality police, into the town of Mogadishu to try and... The main occupation of the police is to check on the businesses, to check that women are appropriately dressed, that men are appropriately dressed. As he put it, no Balotelli haircuts. Balotelli is a soccer player in the UK with a big mohawk. So you have to look demure, no music on your telephone, no smoking. And they cane people who are abroad during the prayer times. Guled is only 16, but he has a wife, because one of the consequences of the war is that people marry very young, that also families are very keen to marry their young daughters because that's a less of a mouth to feed. So he was, another girl at primary school was his wife, also the same age as him. And on one of his first outings as a hizbat, the patrol comes across three young people at a shop. His patrol apprehends these people, puts them on the ground, starts beating them, and it's only when the girl starts squealing that he realizes it's his wife. He doesn't say anything. She doesn't say anything. They look at each other. They realize that if either of them speaks, they're dead. So he goes back to the training camp. She, who had been so far worrying where he was, now knows where he is. And they don't see each other again. A month later, he gets the chance to, I won't go into the details, but he escapes from Al-Shabaab. He then decides that it's too dangerous to go to his wife because they might follow him and they might harm her. So he goes to the refugee camp. He has no real idea of the refugee camp other than it's probably his only option.
Well, I mean, he has an idealized sense of the place beforehand, doesn't he?
Yes, he. I mean, the people's idea of the camp is shaped by rumor, really. Right. That it might be a gateway to resettlement, that probably there's education, which there is, education. So he goes with these ideals in mind, and he knows one boy who used to be at his school who is there, or who he has heard tell is there. So he travels 400 miles through Somalia on a bus, going through checkpoints for Al-Shabaab, desperately holding his breath, hoping that they're not communicating with the Al-Shabaab in Mogadishu. Of course, there are hundreds of runaways from Al-Shabaab. He's nothing special, but he doesn't know that. He gets to the border town, and then he's faced with another challenge, because the camps of Dadaab are 70 miles inside the border with Kenya. There's no official transportation from the border to the camps. If the Kenya police pick you up, their first instinct is to return you to Somalia, because Kenya generally doesn't want more refugees. So the challenge facing the refugees is to get to Dadaab without being stopped by the Kenya police. And when you get there, then you present yourself to the United Nations. They will give you a ration card and register you, and then you're safe. But if you'll get caught in that no man's land between the border and the camp, you can be robbed, raped, beaten up, thrown back. He finds a passage on a sugar truck, because one of the interesting aspects of the border economy is the smuggling of sugar from Somalia into Kenya. That's another story. But he gets on a sugar truck, arrives in the camp, and begins to try, and the first sort of chapters of the book are him trying to make sense of this place, wondering, well, where do I go? There's no fence around the camp. It's, as I said, it's these five sort of, they look like moons from the, if you look on Google Earth, it looks like these grids, these grid-like moons that are orbiting the town of Dadaab. And he arrives in one of them, and he looks out, and what he sees is these big thorn fences, which are what's pretty much the borders of all the roads. They're called kamor, these fences which are lashed together to keep the wind out. And he tries to find his buddy Noor, who he's heard about. And by complete coincidence, later that day, he does actually bump into Noor. And then he lodges with his friend. He has to find his way around to the UN office. Noor shows him where he has to go and present himself and get fingerprinted and have his photo taken and get his ration card and so on. And then he begins the process of going to the ration distribution center, which is this huge warehouse where you get processed, you go through and you get given a spoonful of rice and a spoonful of maize and a spoonful of oil. And he finds out actually that there's no room for him. There's no house because he's a single person. The camps are overcrowded. Kenya has said they're full. There's no more land being allocated for the camps. So he doesn't have anywhere to live. He doesn't have a house in the camp. So, and Noor, of course, is in the same position. He's squatting in somebody else's compound. Once upon a time, the compounds were quite big, with a hut in the middle and then space around them. But since they've been so overcrowded, families will just divide them, cut them up. So you have these houses squashed up against each other, closer and closer and closer, like a sort of farming family in the UK that doesn't want to split the territory. Doesn't want to sell the territory. They keep splitting it into smaller and smaller parcels. So he eventually finds a lodging in the house of somebody else, for which he pays a small amount of rent, which means 1 or 2 days a week that he's hungry because his rations won't stretch. And then he begins to try and make a life in the camp. The first thing he does, in fact, is sell some of his rations to buy a scratch card so he can phone his wife, Mariam, in Mogadishu, so that he can tell her where he is. And they can begin the process of her trying to come to the camp, which is another very, very long story.
I mean, this might have sounded like a very long answer to my question, but he has really begun to touch upon this guy's story. And he could have written a book just about this person, and it would have been a very satisfying book. And in fact, probably a very satisfying movie, because the story of his exit from Somalia is very dramatic, and the bus rides that Ben just sort of mentions in passing were incredible. I mean, I've been in a lot of perilous travel in Africa and like to think, wow, I've experienced danger. But as I read that, I'm thinking, you know, this is going to go bad at any second, like fatally bad. Yeah. It doesn't, obviously. But so one of the remarkable elements where you ended just here is it gets at this kind of existential problem that all of these people in one way or another face, is that so he's dreaming of getting, he's willing to face death to get to this camp.
Yes.
To escape Al-Shabaab, to escape Somalia, right? So in order to attain such a state of motivation, you have to have an idealized view of this other place you're going to, right? That's the only way one can brave those kinds of odds, right?
Yes.
No sooner does he get to this place than he begins to understand just how complicated and how sort of non-utopian the place is.
Yes.
But then something else begins to happen in his mind, which is where you left off, which is, how do I get my wife to come?
Yeah.
Right?
So he will first challenge is to get the money to make the phone call, because there's no ready cash in the camp. And then the phone call, I've interviewed both of them about the phone call, and it was very funny, but also heartbreaking, in the sense that she said, what's it like? And he said, oh, well, you can get resettlement to America, and there's education, and there's food, and there's this, and there's that. She said, oh, okay, how's the war? She said, oh, it's terrible, it's really bad, it's, you know, there's Amazon mortars going off, and so on. And he said, well, come. Okay, great, girl, I'm going to come. So she has this, now has shared the idealized view of the camp, and she said, well, how am I going to come? He said, I need $50 for the bus. How do I get $50 in this camp? There's no, you know, he could have hustled the money perhaps in Mogadishu, but in the camp. So he starts then trying to work in the informal market in the camp to get the $50 so that she can come. Again, long story, but he fails. And she has to borrow money from family members to get on the bus, which she eventually does. She arrives in the camp early 2011. And she's got a secret that she hadn't told Dadaab, which is told Guled, which is before he was kidnapped. She got pregnant. So now she arrives in the camp. She's 6 months pregnant. Of course, he's delighted. She, on the other hand, is horrified. I've come to this, you know, hell on earth, which is 45 degrees. There's nothing to eat. I'm pregnant. I need to eat. I need to feed my, you know, my growing child. And she starts demanding juice and bananas and all this stuff, which he can't get. So their relationship is just under incredible strain. And she ends up having a cesarean because the baby is too big, it's too hot. And she blames the fact that she was unable to have a natural birth on her presence in the camp and on this terrible situation that Guled has got herself in. And she wants to go back to Mogadishu. Her mother-in-law, you know, his mother-in-law, her mother is in Mogadishu. They've got a washing machine in Mogadishu. Yes, there's a war, but it's better than the camp.
She has high expectations and high standards, basically. Yeah.
High maintenance, yeah. But of course, for her, you know, very much. This really gets at the dilemma of the individual level. For her, the camp doesn't make sense, whereas Mogadishu would, despite the fighting. For him, the equation is different. He can't go back to Mogadishu because he's afraid of Al-Shabaab. So that really, I think, shows you the micro decisions that people make and how finely balanced all of these things are. That, you know, it's not that everybody wants to leave or everybody wants to go back. It very much depends on your own personal circumstances. And those personal circumstances are tragic. Inevitably, they're tragic. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's really the commonality. That's the entry point for the story, really, is to appreciate that tragedy.
So if you could just finish this chapter of the ingress with Isha's story, please.
Isha, later that year, in another part of Somalia, the famine in the rural areas is building and building and building. And you may remember the news stories at that time. Of course, it's intimately connected to the war with Al-Shabaab. Isha lives in an Al-Shabaab area. No aid is getting through for various political reasons, both US policy decisions and also Al-Shabaab. Finally, she was a rich lady with her husband. They had lots of camels, they had cattle, all of them are dead. After the last one dies, they finally decide, okay, we're going to go to the camp. Al-Shabaab, curiously enough, give them a 25-kilo sack of rice to allow them to get to the camp. So in that area, they had a humane Al-Shabaab commander. In other areas, they were not so humane. She and five other families then begin the process of walking to the camp because, of course, they don't have money for transportation. In the famine, the cost of transportation went up by about four or five times. So every car was being commandeered and hired for thousands of dollars, so which is why the big outflow from southern Somalia during the famine was on foot. So they joined this flood of people on foot. And it took them 16 days walking at night because it's too hot to walk in the daytime. And they had one donkey cart between the five families. When the kids got tired, they would put the kids on the donkey cart and then they would rotate them because there wasn't enough space on the donkey cart. And when the kids started flagging and not, you know, walking fast enough, then they would start scaring them and pretending there was a lion coming and trying to keep the kids moving because they were so tired, they were so hungry. They also were very, they had to carry water, of course. So Isha was either carrying a child or a 25-litre jerry can on her back the whole way. All of the kids lost the soles of their feet during the walk because the shoes got shredded in the on the hot sand, and then after that, the soles went. So she used to wrap, used to use the water rather than drink it, with wet shreds of cloth and wrap her children's feet in this in the cloth, and then slowly they made it. There, in their little group, nobody died. But overall, I mean, in that period, in the famine in southern Somalia, 250,000 people died, most of them children under five. But she finally made it to the camp. And then at that time, because Kenya had said the camp is full, it's closed, all of these people were piling up in the bush outside the camp. So the camp is a temporary slum, and then there was a sort of temporary suburb of the temporary slum, which was growing to, it peaked at around 70,000 people who were just building huts at the edge of the camp. And of course the services were overstretched in the camp, and they couldn't process all of these people. So even when you got to the camp, you were still waiting 21 days for food, for water, to be given a house and a plastic sheet and blankets and all the rest of it. So people in terrible shape were dying right in the camp, even though they'd actually made it. So 16 days Isha had to make it to the camp, and then another 21 she had to survive until she finally got her rations.
For the second lens, I'd like you to use the stories, if you don't mind, of Muna and Munde. This is a couple that comes together across a religious divide and a nationality divide as well. But I think they help illustrate many dimensions of life in the camp. So if you could just sort of lay some of that out for us.
So the majority population in the camp is 95% Somalis, but there are other populations. Kenya has an encampment policy, contrary to international law, which means that most of the refugees who it grants asylum to, it ships to one of two camps. Dadaab is one, Kakuma is the other. In fact, the second largest refugee camp in the world is Kakuma. There are a large number of Sudanese people who come to seek refuge in Kenya. There's a small population of Sudanese in Dadaab. There's a bigger population in Kakuma. There are also a lot of Ethiopians. There are some Rwandans, some Burundians, Ugandans, Congolese, a few Eritreans. Among the Sudanese population are some lost boys, whose story I think has been explored to some extent here with people like Ishmael Baer and the book by David Eggers about Valentino Deng. So one of Deng's friends was a guy called Munday, who, while several of the lost boys, many of the lost boys were resettled to places like Minnesota, the vast majority still in camps or in the region. And there's a group of Lost Boys in Dadaab. One of them is called Monday. And Monday is still there. He's 35 now. He's not a boy anymore. But he met a young girl called Muna, who was came to the camp when she was 6 months old. And she was forced into a marriage at 14 with her maths teacher, because she had fallen in love with her maths teacher and she'd fooled around with him and that wasn't very good. And she had to marry him. So she married him, and he unfortunately died quite quickly. Then she was forced to marry his older brother, who was much older and who she didn't want to be with. So she had one child from her first marriage. She had another child from the forced marriage to the brother. And she was, basically she ran away. And she wanted to find somewhere safe to be where the family couldn't find her. So she took a job working in the German aid compound as a cook. And the aid agencies all live in Dadaab town in a kind of 3 square kilometer bomb. It's like a green zone with security, with lots of towers and bomb-proof fence. What's it called? Blast walls. Blast walls and barbed wire and so on. So by going to accept this job where she had to live in the German aid agency compound, she was then able to escape the retribution from her family for running away from her second husband. In the German aid agency compound, she met a tall, handsome plumber from Sudan called Monday. And they got to talking, and he thought, you know, they finally got together, and I have to paraphrase a very long story again. It's a love story. It's a movie. I mean, it's like Sleepless in Seattle, but she Sleepless in Dadaab. His story is, and this is part of the beauty of interviewing these people over such a long time, he thought he'd fallen in love with her and this was all great. And
don't we all?
And one day she started complaining, you know, saying, I've got a headache, I've got malaria. And he said, oh, darling, you know, I'll get you paracetamol, I'll take you to the clinic and all this stuff. And then it kept going on and on and on. He thought, you haven't got malaria. And I don't quite know how this worked, but he stole some of her urine and he took it to the clinic and he found out that actually she was pregnant. And he said, what's going on here? Why haven't you told me? And he thought, his version of events is that she fooled him, that she had deliberately got herself pregnant because she wanted to get back at her family. The way that she wanted to shame her family was to have a Christian child, because that was the way of getting revenge at them for forcing her to marry this guy who effectively raped her, because he was he was allowed to, he was her husband under the customary law.
Let me just pause to say, I don't remember this detail, but I know that this is a very common pattern. This does not, I don't mean to express moral approval of any kind, but her original husband's brother inherited her under customary bride inheritance.
Exactly.
Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, they got over this initial hiccup and they continued their relationship and they had the baby. She was fired. He had to run away from his job because the Somali community was wanted to kill him for impregnating one of their daughters. So they had a long process then of trying to run away. So they were always either seeking sanctuary with the police, with the UN, or with their own community. And they had various altercations and falling outs with all of these people as they were trying, and with each other, as they were trying to stay alive and keep the baby. When the baby was finally born, the aid agency arranged for the baby to be born in the Dadaab hospital, not in the town hospital, not in the refugee hospital, because there was a rumor of a plot that the community wanted to seize the infant and sacrifice it, basically, as a because it was an affront to the hardline Muslim community in the camp, especially her family, who were very, very upset. A kind of honor killing, if you like. So after that, their relationship deteriorated further, and he started drinking, and he started hitting her, and she had other relationships, and it all got very complicated. In the end, I'm happy to say, they patched things up. They had another baby. And they finally, after some intervention from me at the very end, after I'd finished the book, it's in the epilogue, they were finally granted the emergency resettlement to Australia that they were supposed to have. So now they live there with their three children.
Which was based on the idea that they were the targets of discrimination because
they were
of this
at risk.
Cross-religious marriage,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But it took 3 years of them living, having met the criteria and been told, yes, we're going to evacuate you to Australia ASAP, it took 3 years for that actually to happen. So that gives you an insight into how bureaucratic and sclerotic the UN can be.
So just to finish with the lenses, under what other circumstances does one manage to escape this world? So Muna and Monday serve two purposes for according to our schema, but are there other ways out?
There are a few ways out. The first one is to return to Somalia and brave the war and make the best of it. The other one is to wait for official resettlement, which is basically like waiting for a lottery ticket. The odds are very slim for that. Most of the resettlement slots are reserved for people who are at risk, so vulnerable people, people like Muna and Monday whose lives are at risk, former child soldiers, people who have particular cases, victims of domestic abuse and so on. So that formal quota system, as I talked about earlier, is very, very, the numbers are very, very small. If you have the money, you can buy a Kenyan ID card or a Kenyan passport. Those are quite expensive, and it's not always guaranteed that the documents are genuine. And even if that is the case, the Kenyan government, in its pogroms against the Somalis, often rounds people up in Nairobi, shreds their documents, and sends them to Dadaab anyway. So even just being Somali in Kenya can be a risky business, even if you have a Kenyan passport. The final option, which is where I left Guled, in fact, at the end of the book, is that if you consider your options and you think that none of these apply to me, I don't have the money to buy my way out, I can't go back to Somalia, I'm not going to get resettlement in the camp, some people try and make the journey to Europe, and it's a long way. But increasingly, that's what young people are doing. It costs around $10,000. People in the camp might have a little bit of money. They probably don't have that much. But what tends to happen is extended family will invest in one person's journey with the idea that they will then get repaid at the end of it. So that's a model that we're seeing more and more. And the other route, not just to Europe, is to the United States via South Africa by boat into Brazil or South America and then up through Mexico. And that route, the traffickers charge more like $25,000. But the returns, I think, are probably better than Europe.
I'd like to shift directions a little bit and talk about the way the outside world responds to all of this. And I'd like to use two, we could slice this very thinly and talk about lots of different entities, but we don't have time to do that. So I'd like to talk about two particular states, this country and Kenya. There's a really intriguing passage at the very beginning of the book where Ben is called in, I think, to the White House to have a meeting with the National Security Council and to brief them on the situation in these refugee camps. And I read this with sort of my jaw agape for several reasons. To be fair to the audience, so the National Security Council, I don't know why they invited you in the first place. Maybe you want to explain that a bit. Mm-hmm. But My recollection is that once they understood that your story was that most of these people do not risk becoming Islamic militants, then the White House's attitude was, well, then why should we care about them? Is that correct?
They didn't say it like that, but that was definitely the impression I walked away with.
Right.
I mean, I went there as an activist. Part of my role, both for Human Rights Watch and as an OSF fellow, is to meet with policymakers and to try and lobby them and give them information about the work that we're doing. So part of my goal in writing the book and doing the research was to try and debunk this myth that refugee camps are hotbeds of extremism, because so much lazy policy is based on this assumption. And it's pretty much a given in liberal thinking that poverty and marginalization and human rights abuse generally contribute to radicalization. In fact, the empirical research that is out there is pretty unclear. It doesn't really point to any kind of links. And my experience in the camp was that there was certainly no clear relationship between poverty and extremism. There might have been a very simple utilitarian one, in the sense that some people who were poor might be more likely to accept jobs with Al-Shabaab because Al-Shabaab pays a salary. But there certainly wasn't any direct link with young people in the camp feeling that because they were forgotten and marginalized that Al-Shabaab offered a better future for them. That was certainly not the case. So the meeting in the White House was to try and explain this and to say, listen, you're funding the Kenyan security services, you're pretty much tacitly supporting this policy of scapegoating the refugees and beating them up every time a bomb goes off in Kenya. And actually, you need to understand that the camp is not... Kenya keeps saying that, we need to close the camp because it's full of extremists. And I was trying to say, well, actually, that's not really true. If you go there, and of course, none of the US embassy staff are allowed to go there because it's too dangerous for them, the real picture on the ground is very different, that you have these grids which are very easily policed. The surveillance is quite strong. There's a good relationship with the local police. There's a community policing program. The residents live in these very tightly knit communities where they've been for 25 years. They all know each other. If somebody from another clan shows up, who's a stranger from Somalia, he's very quickly identified, and the police are called, and the person's taken away. So, the idea that Al-Shabaab's planning all these big attacks in the camp is completely nonsense. But I confess to an uncomfortable irony, really, which is that all of the time that I've been doing this kind of liberal advocacy, the idea... The narrative has always been, you must look after this camp, you must treat these people better because otherwise they might get radicalized. And actually, this, my own research, problematizes that quite a bit. It doesn't necessarily follow at all. At which point I saw the people in the National Security Council just sort of relax and bring the meeting quietly to a close. Well, in that case, I did try and make the point, and I've made the point since in other fora, which is that if you want to do counter-radicalization, the first thing to do is don't call it that. The second thing to do is to recognize that the most effective way of inoculating kids against this kind of ideology is primary education. What Al-Shabaab's main targets in northern Kenya and in Somalia are primary schools, because they want the madrasas to be the only option. So foreign policy for me in the Horn of Africa is really very simple and very cheap, but somehow beyond the grasp of the clever people in Washington.
I want to challenge that a little bit.
Sure.
Not to defend the people in Washington. But there's a line in your book which says the biggest casualty of the civil war in Somalia is the idea of the Somali state. And I think that's just right. Mm. And so if that's true, and if one byproduct of this war has been this immense population of refugees, then what, beyond the question of radicalization, what should a reasonable foreign policy approach be to this part of Africa that will, among its byproducts, in time perhaps help alleviate the refugee crisis?
Mm. There's so much that needs to be done. There's so much that's wrong. One of the interesting things I learned about the view from Dadaab, looking at Kenyan politics, looking at regional politics from the perspective of the refugee camp, was just how similar the conflict economy of southern Somalia looks to the DRC, to Congo, where, in fact, the war is, in a way, business by other means, where the Kenyan state has pretty much annexed southern Somalia through its proxy, this state called Jubaland, and it's controlling all of the trade from the Kismayu port down into Nairobi, and there are very big interests at stake. The whole of the Kenyan domestic sugar market has pretty much been geared to the military operation there to make sure that 30% of the Kenyan sugar market, which is supplied from smuggled sugar, which keeps one of the characters in the book in business because he works in the market and that's his thing. So my introduction to this was watching the price of sugar going up and down in the market and realizing how it connected to the regional politics. But that, we're talking about probably $500 million that's at stake in that particular economy that the Kenyan army has its finger in. The problem then for the United States and other allies who want to engage and who want to find partners in the region with Kenya and Ethiopia is that they do know that, but nonetheless they need partners. They need people they can work with. They need forces they can share intelligence with and so on. So it's very, very problematic, and nobody wants to acknowledge that Kenya is not an honest broker, is not an honest broker in Somalia. Ethiopia is not an honest broker in Somalia. And the first thing that anybody talks about in a discussion about regional politics in the camp or in Somalia as a whole is the borders that the British and the Italians and the Ethiopians drew in 1885. That quarter of Ethiopia is Somalia. Quarter of Kenya is Somalia. Djibouti is Somalia. So these are all, you know, big, and that means that the domestic politics of Kenya and Ethiopia play out in Somalia, and the domestic politics of Somalia play out in those regions of Kenya. So it's no surprise that the Ogaden region of Ethiopia is at war, that northeast province of Kenya has been at war and is still unstable. So I think my shorthand reading of the international approach to the region is that they don't appreciate the history enough, even if they understand it, and they don't care enough about trying to resolve it. I mean, it's not, there isn't the level of engagement, for example, as there was with South Korea or, you know, or rebuilding Japan after World War II. There's nowhere near that kind of engagement. There is a token engagement. There is money being spent. It's the largest amount of money on the table, but it's by no stretch is it going to be enough to you know, bring the state together. And there is a very, one last point, there is quite a short-sighted policy in Somalia, which I think matches what the US has previously done in Afghanistan, which is this very utilitarian approach to paying off warlords who we can work with for particular short-term projects to get particular people or bring stability to particular areas at the expense of the nation. And of course these are kind of free radicals.
This is familiar in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Yeah. I mean, you find local intermediaries, and to the extent they're useful to you, you avert your eyes to whatever bad news
and
attaches to them.
You're undermining the overall goals in the long term. I don't know what it's called in Afghanistan or Iraq, but they call it the two-track policy in Somalia. And actually it's kind of one track undermining the other track, as far as I can tell.
This idea of not caring enough is another motif that runs through the book, and it's expressed in a very different area, which is the response to the material needs, and in specific the nutritional needs of these refugees. So you have these arresting scenes in the book where the UN and various other relief community characters who inhabit a very sort of special insular world in Nairobi, begin to formulate these dire forecasts that they pretty, and it's good science. They pretty much know for sure that in 3 months there's going to be X number of people who are not covered and likely to starve, and they begin to send, you know, alarm messages to Geneva and to New York and to various other places, and then they knock off and they go to sort of fancy bars and have their nice expat evening in Nairobi, right? Just how, you know, hopeless this all is. I mean, there's this incredible fatalism that attaches to the whole thing, right? But is there really any solution to that? I mean, how do you ever get beyond that?
Well, I think what I tried to do both more specifically for the refugees, but also for the other actors in the region, is to try and show the big picture, really, is to show that the UN is made up of these well-meaning people who are working in very difficult situations and who are constrained on all corners. The refugees are constrained in so many ways, and their imagination then sort of fits the space that's allotted. And I think the ambition and the compassion of the aid workers in a way operates in a similar way. They do what they can, and then they realize that nobody's listening to the famine early warning system, which incidentally is working well since all the lessons we've had over the last 20 years. But at the end of the chain, you're pressing the alarm button and the fire brigade's not coming because the political decision has not been made, and that's really it was the problem. But those guys who are making those messages, who are trying to work within the system, nonetheless have to accommodate their daily life to their job. So they shut the door, they go and get drunk. You know, I mean, that's how, as many of you know who've worked in the region, that's how people cope in these situations. And, you know, they're having mental health issues too, just perhaps of a lesser order.
I wanted to save time for questions, but I have a final kind of a writer's question for you. I use the phrase, the cliched phrase, fly on the wall. The book is not told in first person. Of course, it's told in third person, but it's told to very often extraordinary sort of degree of detail, as if, and these are stories that extend far back in time, and you know, somebody washing their clothes one morning or cooking, you know, a specific meal. As a reader, I wrestled with that, not because I didn't find the prose absorbing, which I really did, but because I wondered, and this isn't a fault, really, because I have the privilege of being able to ask you, I wondered, you know, how does one know which pieces are reconstituted and if that's a lot. How did you manage that? I mean, I don't know how you pulled that off. You pulled it off well. Mm. And which pieces are witnessed?
Right. Well, if I ever have the privilege of teaching a non-fiction class, one of the challenges...
I might be able to help you with that.
one of the tasks I'd like to set the students is to try and identify which bits was I present in the room and which bits have I...
Because I'm a writer, I couldn't stop wondering page by page.
Yeah.
I mean, it really became a fixation.
Okay. Well, I'm honored that that was a problem or an observation. What I very much tried to do was to try and make it seamless. And as much as possible, I was in the room with the people as things were happening. But what I also did was... multiple interviews of a kind that, you know, other journalists have pioneered, like Barbara Demick and Catherine Boo and people like that. So, for example, Monday and Muna, I would interview Monday at great length and lots of drama, and then I would interview Muna, and then I would go back to Monday, and then I would go back to Muna, and actually the story evolved as I did it, because on the third time I interviewed Muna, she said, well, actually, yeah, he's right. You know, I did kind of cheat him. I knew it was my time. So, you know, you sort of immerse, the picture builds up like that. And then, of course, I interviewed Muna's mum, and I interviewed her best friend and other people and tried to cross-check and, you know, like that. And then with the there was two sort of models. One was that sort of close reportage of the journalists I've spoken about. The other was I studied quite closely The Grapes of Wrath, which is also an attempt to try and humanize a disaster, to try and focus public attention on the intimate stories, but to relate it to the bigger political forces. So for those, again, like the London Conference on Somalia, I was there in the fringes and I talked to some of the Foreign Office officials and so on. I saw the room. And so I can, it was from there. But then the communique and what was agreed later, that again is from in secondary interviews later on. So I've tried to build up the whole equation, really, so that at this point, when we're talking about the refugee crisis, you can see the whole picture. You can see the people at the center of it, why they fled, the reasons why they're stuck in this place, the effect that has on them, the political impasse, if you like, that keeps them there, and all of these policies and so on, and these themes like the war on terror and so on, which shape their experience and which prevent us from fully appreciating their lives. So it's an attempt to get the whole picture.
You also avoid, just as a matter of technique, you avoid a lot of he said, she said, which I think helps you pull off this, I don't want to call it a trick because that sounds cheap, but this, whatever it is, this exploit of kind of making the thing real.
Yeah, I generally set the accounts against each other, This is according to Muna, and then Monday said, da 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 da, and yeah. I don't know what to say, really.
Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I think we'll take questions now.
Hi, my name is Margot Viscusi. I'm a retired editor and writer. I just want to comment the analogy with the Palestinian network of Palestinian camps is very interesting. This is much more dynamic with people going in as well as reproducing in those camps. But I have a technical question. How did you handle language problems in your deep interviews with people?
Some of the characters, some of the people speak English and Swahili, and I speak those two languages. Some of the others only spoke Somali, and for those, I had a succession of translators, but one guy in particular who did most of that.
I am Kevin Kelly. I'm the U.S. and U.N. correspondent for the Nation Media Group.
Nice to
in
see
Kenya.
You in the flesh.
It sounds like a great book, Ben. I'm really looking forward to reading it, so yeah, thanks for doing this, too. So are you saying that there's no Shabab presence at all in Dadaab? And I have a second question, too. I mean, given the corruption, given the back and forth across the border, given the surreptitious behavior on all sides, I would think that there must be some Shabab influence in Dadaab. The Kenyans certainly think so. And secondly, is this camp going to be there pretty much forever? I mean, the UN wants to repatriate people gradually as security, if it ever does improve in Somalia. Do you think that significant numbers of people will go back to Somalia, or this older generation, the aristocracy, and as people age, the younger generations, they're not going to go anywhere? This is becoming a permanent Somali community. I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
Sorry, remind me the first point again.
Shabab.
Oh, yeah. No, Shabab is there, but very, very transient. I mean, people come and go. The core population that live there, there may be some sympathizers who are passing on information and so on, but their influence is very, very limited. And it's mostly to do with Somalia. It's not to do with the population in the camp. And the people in Garissa. I mean, Shabab is in Garissa much more than it is in the camp, with Garissa is the nearest largest town, where the university where Shabab executed a lot of people. Dadaab is here to stay, in my view, even if some people go back to Somalia and some people sort of bleed away into Kenya. There will be a core of the city for sure, because it functions, and because for many people they've invested, they've built houses. Concrete is illegal, but people have started pouring concrete in some of the older camps. So I think it's going to be very, very hard to uproot a city the size of New Orleans Just like that. I don't think it's going anywhere. The wider point is that there are more and more of these refugee cities, and they are lasting longer and longer. And the Palestinian example is signal, because the Palestinian situation was supposed to be the exception, that the refugees were there pending an international settlement, which, of course, never comes. But that is increasingly the situation for everybody else now. You're supposed to be a refugee pending a durable solution, and the durable solution never arrives. So more and more, Gaza is the future, I think, for the camps in Chad, the camps in Kenya, the camps in southern Ethiopia, the camps in Yemen, Sudan, CFR. I can go on, but, you know, I think we, the world, and, you know, the people concerned with international policy need to find ways of dealing with this fact. Rather than pretending that these places are temporary, we need to start treating them as permanent and trying to get around the legal obstacles to treating them as permanent and giving them the provision that they need, giving them perhaps the movement that they need, allowing them to work, finding some sort of way of making the life there a bit more bearable.
Hi, I'm Laurie. Thank you so much for the... I'm looking forward to reading the book. So I'm a disaster and emergency mental health specialist and working with refugees and displaced people, and you mentioned coping. And I've worked in other areas of the world, and I'm curious, in such an established, long-lasting camp, if there are services, mental health or behavioral health, psychosocial services provided to both the expat community, and if so, if that's accessible and well-received, and then also to the inhabitants of the camp, and if that is offered in a culturally appropriate way rather than Western models instilled in them. Mm.
There is a little bit of mental health provision for the refugees, not very much, but there is also there's a cultural barrier in the sense that people are often referred for counselling, but they don't go. So no matter how culturally appropriate you try and make the counselling, people will avoid it because they're not familiar with, you know, that that as a solution, really. So there's some of it. I'm not aware of any psychosocial counselling for the expatriate staff. But expatriate's the wrong word, really, because in Dadaab now, because white skin has such a premium, most of the aid workers are Kenyans. There's been a big shift towards hiring many more what they call national staff rather than international staff.
Hi, I'm Beryl Goldberg. I'm a freelance photojournalist and have spent a lot of time in Africa, many places. But do you have any, and this is like average American, I heard you on the radio the other day and said, I can't stand this, I want to do something, but I know... aid agencies are in such disrepute. I mean, what the average, ideally, both of you actually think of what people can do to...
Well, I think part of the challenge of the refugee crisis we face at the moment is changing our own societies to be more adaptable, to be more welcoming. Europe is undergoing a bit of an existential crisis, but that Germany is coping much better than other countries, perhaps because it's had a reckoning with its past, and it has less of a sort of nature, or at least ideas of nationhood in Germany are perhaps a bit more discredited than they might be in other more blinkered societies like Britain, for example. So I think there's something to be done in terms of our own national societies. I think that there are definitely organizations that are doing good things. It's always a question, I think, with when you want to support work in another country or in an area that you don't necessarily understand intimately, it's always hard to find people that you trust and who you think are doing good work. In my view, Médecins Sans Frontières, hands down, every time, in every crisis, they're just fantastic. They're always there, they work with everybody. They also do advocacy, which they speak up about the things they see, which people like Save the Children and Oxfam often can be a bit more hesitant about doing. So I'm a big fan of theirs. The other interesting thing in the camp is this private Canada is the only country that allows private sponsorship of resettlement for refugees. Some countries in Europe are starting to pilot programs, but it would be great if the United States started looking into it. What that means is a group of people get together, raise $80,000 or $100,000 to sponsor the one person to come from Dadaab rather than the cost of, or wherever, you know, wherever you choose to sponsor somebody. And that is a private route out of a protracted refugee situation rather than waiting to fulfill a government quota, which, of course, the numbers are always politicized. Part of that is also, I mentioned Cairo, this girl who wanted to go to Kenya. There's a trust that works with refugee camps across the world, providing and coordinating these scholarships for young girls and young boys to go to university out of refugee camps. And that trust is called the Windle Trust, W-I-N-D-L-E. And I'm a supporter of theirs, and I also often tell people that to look into that if you're interested in supporting young people to have education from refugee camps.
Hi, my name is Kristen Timeson, and I'm with FilmAid International here in New York, but I worked with FilmAid in Kenya and have been to Dadaab a few times, so we probably crossed paths, I think. But I wanted to ask if you've been able to talk with any Kenyan government leaders or Kenyan media leaders at all, because I know a lot of a durable solution, one of the possible durable solutions of being able to stay in Kenya, really relies on them. And so I was wondering if you'd had a chance to speak with them at all.
Mm. They laugh at me, the Kenyan government. No, they're not interested. I mean, there are some people in the Kenyan establishment who are sympathetic to refugees, but by and large, it's very conservative, very hostile. What we would call right wing, you know, possibly fascist approach to the refugees is very scary how the Kenyan establishment views them. Media leaders, there's a section in the book actually about where I met media leaders at the time of what they called Usalama Watch. So the Kenyan government rounded up all the undocumented refugees and put them back to Dadaab, but not just refugees, pretty much anybody that looked Somali. And there was this very frightening level of xenophobia in the Kenyan press. And I and another OSF fellow, but a fellow of the Open Society in Kenya, went to meet media leaders and said, "What's going on? You need to cool it down." And they said, they were very frank. They said, "We've never seen anything like it. You know, we agree with you and we're trying. And in our editorial meetings, this is a live issue, but people are spitting blood because there were bombs going off in Nairobi and everybody wanted to blame the Somalis." So, yeah, the US and the UK and all these other countries have a similar problem, you know, perhaps to a lesser pitch. But, you know, we all have a role, I think, in all of our societies in trying to encourage intelligent debate about that.
I enjoyed this very much. My name is Robin Groth. I'm a former CNN correspondent. And the stories that you've told today are very touching. But what I want to know is what your life was like. You were embedded there in many respects. And how did this experience change you? What did you learn about yourself? And how did you cope?
I'm tempted to say I never want to leave home again, but I think that's just because I've had a baby recently. I was there for 7 months on and off, but because of the security problems, I was in the green zone. I was in the UN camp, so I would have to go out through the security gates every day with my car and my driver and my translator, and then I had another truck full of armed guards who would usually stay a distance away and drink tea for a couple of hours, and then we would go away and then we'd come back again because they had a two-hour limit. I wasn't allowed to be in one place for more than 2 hours. That then shrunk to 1 hour, and then in the end that was half an hour because there was an elevated kidnap threat towards the end of my stay there. So it made the research quite tricky. I think I managed to keep a distance during all of the research, gathering all of this information, assembling it, and I channeled a lot of my sense of injustice about the situation into the book. That's why I wrote the book. That's why I get exercised and I can shout on NPR and elsewhere. And it's because I felt that I felt angry about the situation, and I've tried to control, put that into a controlled fashion into the book. On a personal note, I didn't cry during any of that research, although I felt for all of those people. What for me was the most heartbreaking thing was before Christmas, I sent a box of books to the camp, to all of these people, and I had to write in each and dedicate them to that person, and I didn't know what to say. I said, thank you for sharing your story, and I hope that maybe it might have some positive outcome, but I think both they know and I know that that's probably not the case. So that's when I cried, was then.
Can you elaborate on that just a little bit more, on those discussions, even as people start jumping into the project with you? The what's in it for me, what's the outcome, why are they doing this?
I was quite clear right from the beginning that this has very little benefit for you, and they understood that. And they, most of them, no, all of them, in fact, were very clear. Like, that's okay, it's great to see you, we'd like to talk to you. They want somebody to listen to them. They want their story to matter. They don't want to be just another number on a ration card. And so this was also exciting. This was an opportunity to participate in something. Several of the people are unemployed. They're sitting around. When I show up and buy everybody lunch and bring presents from London, it's great, And we chat and I was quite clear about the risks as well. So Guled we changed his name. And we changed his wife's name, and we had to camouflage certain aspects. But everybody else, I was very clear about what it meant and what it might mean. I also had to be clear that there is a slim chance that by participating in this, that their story might come to somebody's attention. There might be a book club in Canada that wants to sponsor a university place for Cairo, for example, even though she missed the formal opportunity. Or Muna and Monday, their case, their emergency resettlement case, was lost. But at the end of the research, I went and followed up with the UN and said, what's going on? I had followed up before, but they had fobbed me off and said, it's private, you can't look at this stuff. And then I found somebody who was more sympathetic. And they finally checked. And they said, sorry, this file's been lost. So for 3 years, they were sitting there waiting. Why isn't it moving? Why is our case not moving? So finally, that case moved. I did use some of my advance to buy Guled a motorbike so he can start a business and make life a little bit better. So there are little things that, there has been some benefit for them in small ways.
I think for what many in the audience who are not journalists might not realize, at least in my experience, is the power of, it's a very simple thing, but that feels alien to lots of people with regard to strangers, that a stranger should be genuinely interested in your life and writing about it. So you're one person in a crowd, and a stranger who has this vocation to be a journalist approaches you and is willing to undergo hardship personally and to travel distances and to sit out long hours, and because simply they want to know your story, is an incredibly powerful thing. And so I think that even though you had this kind of pro forma disclaimer that you used with them, that this is not going to liberate you from your fate necessarily, I think that I'm imagining that this was another kind of sort of psychic reward for them. That's certainly been my experience as a reporter.
Yeah. Tawane, for those of you that find out about him in the book, he was on CBC radio in Canada last week because they asked me if they could speak to him, and I asked him and he said he'd be happy. And for him, that was fantastic. He said, he was on the radio, he was able to tell 23 million listeners in Canada that the people in Dadaab are running out of hope, and please remember us. And he was, you know, very happy for that opportunity. And I, you know, we're friends, and I'm still in touch with everybody on Facebook, and, you know, hopefully let's see how things go. But, you know, just because they're there doesn't mean now they're at least participating in another conversation, which is something.
Final question from me, Ben. Is there a sense, perhaps, in which the timing of refugee crises as an issue on the global agenda, which is focused on very different groups of refugees, is unfortunate for these people? In other words, if the embodiment of the refugee in the global imagination today is somebody coming from Syria, and that's already in itself overwhelming, does this objectively or at least in the imaginations of these people hurt their cause?
It hurts them in both ways. I think at the macro level, there is a benefit in the sense that any attention to refugees is good, and we are seeing some policy movement, some more creative thinking about how to unlock protracted refugee situations. There certainly has been a flurry of high-level panels and thinking and so on about Dadaab, as well as other refugee situations. So that's good. But on the day-to-day level, the focus on Syria has been actually quite harmful, because for the last 3 years now, every November, the World Food Programme is facing a funding crunch, and it cuts food rations. So the end of the book, Guled, this is last year, but I know it's true this year as well, is going hungry because the food rations have been slashed, because the numbers from Syria are too great. And the political attention on Syria means that the Syrian rations are not cut, but all the other refugees that are out of the spotlight are going hungry because of Syria. And they feel that resentment quite strongly. Monday and Muna told themselves that the reason their case had been lost was because it was the turn of Syria now, and they'll come back to us when they've done dealt with the Syrians. So that was the story that they made up for themselves. They had no real reason for believing that, but that was what they thought.
My name is Julia Newman. I'm a documentarian. I wonder, once you'd gotten your footing and felt like you knew to some degree where you were, did you think of trying to bring in a tiny crew and shoot any of this and make a documentary?
I've been approached by film crews many times about going to Dadaab, and all of them get very excited when I tell them about Dadaab. And as soon as we talk about the security risks and the costs of going there, they all lose interest quite quickly.
Well, with that, Howard, did you want to say?
I just wanted to say thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both of you.